Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today's July 23rd, 2018, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. I'm actually recording this intro from under a blanket in a very loud hotel room in Colorado. Hopefully it's working out, my little makeshift recording studio. I want to thank those of you who come back week after week to listen to Talk Nerdy and support the show. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download, and that's really because of the listener support from people just like you. If you're interested in supporting the show, becoming a patron, as it were, you can visit patreon.com/talknerdy. That's patreon.com/talknerdy. The highest patrons this week include Rob Schreck, who is supporting at the highest level. Thank you so much, Rob. We really couldn't do this without you. It means an awful lot to me, and I know it means an awful lot to the listeners of the show. I also want to thank Phil T-Bear, the zombie drummer. Hate to say that wrong. David J. E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payett, Jonathan Wright, the honorable husband, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. And if my voice sounds tired right now, it's because I'm so tired. I'm in Chicago, as I mentioned, for a week of school. You know, my PhD program in clinical psych is a distributed learning model, which means that we do a lot of stuff online and then we get together periodically throughout the year for these intensive week-long sessions. And I am finishing up a session right now while I'm recording this because the podcast never sleeps and never goes on break, but I've been in class all day, every day for the past several days. I think I'm losing my voice a little bit, actually. But yeah, in case you were wondering, that's what's going on. Guys, this week is a really great episode. And speaking of going to school, we're going to talk about that quite a bit in this episode. Let me tell you about it. I sit down with, or sit down remotely, actually, she's not in studio, but I sit down with Eugenia Bone, and she is a nature and food writer and author. So, you know, she is a member of the National Association of Science Writers. She's written quite a lot of science and nature, but it's really interesting because she's also written a lot of food and kind of judged a lot of food and wine competitions. So she has this great intersection. Like, she's written for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, but also food and wine and gourmet. And she has a new book. It's just fascinating, called Microbia, A Journey into the Unseen World Around You. So yeah, she wrote a previous book about mushrooms that was a bestseller called Mycophilia. And while she was researching that book, she really became interested in microbes and went back to school for a little while to learn a little bit more about the microbiome, which is, as I can attest to, not an easy task. So I hope you liked the interview as much as I did. I had an awful lot of fun with it. Without any further ado, let's dive right in. Here she is, Eugenia Bone. Well, Eugenia, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Kara. I'm glad to be here.
I am really excited to talk about your new book. I want to make sure I'm pronouncing it right. It's Microbia, right? That's how you would say that word? Okay.
Yes.
Microbia, A Journey into the Unseen World Around You. And of course, what that's really referring to is all the little things that we can't see, but that are definitely there in large, large number.
That's the truth. I mean, so large, it's, you know, it's the true definition of the word awesome, used properly in terms of microbes.
Yeah. And microbes are literally everywhere, aren't they? Yeah. Like everywhere
in every type of environment, from 7 miles deep beneath the ocean floor to 40 miles into the atmosphere. You know, there's so many of them that, you know, you can't even come up with a word to describe the number. You have to say like 5 plus 30 zeros.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. That's, you know, it's funny because we really didn't evolve, I think, to have a very good appreciation of scale on, in terms of like really small things and really, really big things. And so numbers like that are meaningless to us, even up to like multiple orders of magnitude. Like, I think it's really hard to tell the difference between something with 5 zeros and something with 4 zeros and something with 6 zeros.
Exactly. But I think, you know, one of the things that helps is to use, when, like, what I do with microbia is I try to use, you know, metaphors and analogies to make up for that deficit that we have. So you can say more than there are stars in the sky. And that tends to, you know, kind of help people understand just how big these numbers are.
That's insane, by the way. Is it really more than there are, like, the stars that we can see?
That's what they say. That's what the scientists say. I mean, the science, you know, that's the analogy that's usually used. So, yeah, it's amazing. And they're so tiny, you know, like thousands of them can fit into the, you know, or hundreds of thousands into a period at the end of a sentence. So that's another thing that's really, you know, we're so scale deficient that we can't imagine easily.
And I mean, with some of these things, obviously, most of them, we just don't notice. Some of them do they all contribute, but some of them contribute in perceptible ways. Like there might be a smell that we notice from bacteria, or some of them can actually make us very, very sick. And it's interesting that things that are that small and sometimes in incredibly small numbers can have a profound effect.
Yeah. But one of the things that's really kind of coming out about microbiology is that bacteria, for example, they're ultimately plural organisms. Like if I shook your hand and I had a little plague bacterium on my hand, it's not going to really do very much. But if there is a quorum of bacteria, if there's a number of them and they're growing and they're increasing, then they can make stuff happen, can turn on genes, can present virulence. So it's a, you know, in fact, you don't even use the word bacterium very often.
Yeah, that's true. There's like one bacterium is like, whatever. He's
what
cool.
What is it? It really doesn't do very much at all. But there are so many, and it's a quorum that makes shit happen.
Yeah, and they divide so quickly, right? Like, a generation of bacteria is, you know, before your eyes. Like, it happens really fast.
Oh, yeah. Like, I think it's E. coli has this incredible ability to, like in 36 hours, given enough food and water, you know, given what it needs, which is implausible, in 36 hours, one E. coli bacterium can increase to enough number to cover the planet in a foot thick of E. coli.
That's insanity.
Right? That's intense. But it's implausible, right? It's not going to happen.
But that much E. coli would definitely make you sick.
It would be like E. coli planet. And that's like some of these fantasies people have. Are we going to infect Mars with bacteria? You know, that's the sort of next step fantasy that some folks have indulged in, that, you know, we could introduce a bacterium and it would have what it needs to increase to such numbers that it would disrupt the entire, you know, planetary system of some
interesting
off place.
Mm. Yeah, because there's no other microbiota there. There's nothing else to keep it in check.
Or none of its normal predators. It would be like, you know, the ultimate invasive species.
You don't even see it invading.
Yeah, exactly. Until it's too many. Yeah, until it's too late.
Wow. And of course, this book came about after Mycophilia, which was your book about mushrooms.
Yeah, yeah. I got into... Mycophilia is a book about fungi and mushrooms. And there was this one lifestyle of fungi. They're called endophytic fungi, and they live between the cells of all plants. And that really kind of blew my mind. I was like, this fungus lives between its cell, and it's in all plants that have been looked at. And it turns out these endophytic fungi are doing immune-type services on behalf of the plant. They sort of pay their rent by helping the plant deal with various conditions, environmental conditions that are problematic, and predators. And then at the same time as I was kind of wrapping up Mycophilia, and I started to see these headlines about the gut microbiota, you know, and how these bacteria and other organisms that live in our guts provide a whole array of services. And that was just kind of mind-blowing to me, because I had already realized that individual plants are collectives. And then I was like learning, like everybody else, that we are collectives. And this notion that I operate independently of the world, like I'm the only one who feels the effect of my decisions, that was just blown out of the water.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just didn't have the biology chops to really make sense of the stuff I was reading in the newspapers, you know. So I went on this kind of personal study of microbiology to understand myself or and them and how they are me and I am and I am them.
So when you say you went on this kind of personal study, like you went back to school.
I did in middle age. And I'm telling you, it was not easy. It was like really pretty shocking. You know, I was an English major in the Reagan era, for God's sake. So going back to school to study biology with no science background was a real leap for me. But I ended up writing about that experience of what it was like to learn, as well as the microbiology I learned. So it's kind of like what I learned and what it was like learning it. And I wrote about it because I really wanted to share the doability of a non-scientific person or a person who doesn't think they have the science gene to actually learn enough to be able to make some, you know, some decisions about their own bodies and their and how they interact with their environment based on science.
It really is empowering, isn't it? Taking the time to study these things and to understand them at a level of depth that's just even a little bit beyond, I think, superficiality.
Totally. It's totally empowering. And it also leads to, I think, to a kind of responsibility. You know, I have this quote above my desk that I've been keeping around from Arthur Miller. I'm going to paraphrase it for you, but it's, "The apple cannot be stuck back on the tree of knowledge. Once we begin to see, we're doomed to see more, not less." And so that's what the science, going back to school and studying microbiology was like for me. It just, I made a commitment in a way. I'm doomed to see more. And with that comes a kind of responsibility in how I would interact with my own body and also with the greater and my greater environment.
So before we get into some of the like nuts and bolts and interesting tidbits that you learned along the way about microbiology, I would love to talk a little bit more about the experience of going back to school. Because, you know, I am enduring this right now. I took 10 years off between starting a PhD and dropping out and deciding to go back, switch majors, because I was working on a PhD more in the neurosciences. And now I am studying clinical psychology. And it is a bitch.
I bet.
It is not easy, like relearning how to write academically. Oh, I hate it. Don't you hate it?
Oh, the memorization and all that stuff. I mean, there's a lot of pressure. And the kids, I don't know how some of those students managed it. I mean, what, taking that one biology course turned me into a total jerk. You know, I was unwashed and grouchy. I didn't take care of any of my share of the household responsibilities. I remember one time we had this poor house guest who came in the middle of, you know, the week that I was studying for exams. And I showed him how to work our rather daunting espresso machine once, just once. And when he came into my office, wandered in holding the filter in his hand with a confused expression on his face, I said, "Mikey, go to a fucking Starbucks."
So I love it. You're like, "I am busy."
Yeah, it was a just degeneration of all of my etiquette and manners. And my poor husband was, you know, he waited like 2 years, you know, before he had his a companionable person back in his life. I think I turned into a teenager. I was like sneaking cigarettes and eating Ritz crackers. I mean, it's amazing how quickly we spiral down. But the experience in the classroom was, you know, they were, it was also kind of unique because in a way I had the benefit of a kind of witness type role that I didn't have when I was a student first time around. Mm-hmm. So I noticed things like, for example, I noticed that we always sat in the same seats. Once we kind of, in the first week, established where we were going to sit, every student sat in that same seat. And I was curious about it. And I read a little bit and I reported a little bit on what people think that means. And we were in the lectures, bio lectures were held in this beautiful hall that had those desks, the tablet style desks. They're really quite small, about the size of a breadboard. I was quite proud of myself because I had been able to repurpose these marble notebooks that my son had used in school. And he would write like you know, 4 pages on the Trojan War and then, you know, move on to another one. So I would just rip out those pages on the Trojan War, and I saved those marble books for a really long time. And so I was really happy to use them when I was for my notebooks in class, but they're about, one page is about the width of that tablet desktop. So mm-hmm. when I would write on the left-hand side, the right-hand side page would hang over the edge. And as a student, I was extremely hardworking and earnest. I was like the kind of person you want to slap. You know, I was just like learning.
You're reminding the professor that they forgot to assign the homework.
Oh, yeah, totally, totally.
Oh, I hated that kid.
But that's, you know, I was really invested in a different way. You know, for some of those kids, I think, taking a bio class was like getting a colonoscopy. It's just something they had to do. And then they were going to get to move on. Yeah. But for me, it was like I was very ambitious to learn for myself. So one day, and it was early in the year, and there's this guy that always sat to my right in that first couple of weeks. And I was taking a notes very, very earnestly, you know, paying a lot of attention on one side. I had been taking notes on the left-hand page of the notebook. The right-hand page is falling over the tablet desktop, and this guy is sitting to my right. And I felt him looking at me, and I looked over, and he was looking down at the at my open notebook page. And so I looked too, only to see that I had a picture, an illustration that my son had done of a guy screwing a girl on a desk. I know. I had not ripped out every doodle, obviously. And so, needless to say, the next time at the next class, he was no longer sitting to my right.
He's like the one kid in class who moved. That's
exactly.
So funny.
Got it.
Oh my gosh. It's so, I love this. I love that. I mean, I think that a lot of authors, especially, well, historically, but also more recently, have taken the approach in science writing, especially, of the sort of memoir meets the subject matter approach. And I absolutely love that you were unafraid and undaunted to insert yourself into the story and to talk about your experience going back to school, because it's so relatable for so many people. And even though not everybody goes back to school later in life, I mean, I think it's actually a very small percentage of people who decide to do that. More and more, we are seeing people that have to switch careers. More and more, we're seeing people that realize that, you know, they need to be updated with their technology training, whatever the case may be. And it's clumsy. It's really clumsy. And it's nice to kind of, I don't know, commiserate a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I didn't really make a plan to do it this way originally. It just wasn't evolved. But I found that this notion that if I was going to share what I was learning, if I was going to share the story of basic microbiology, which I knew was important, that my friends had all these kind of nutty ideas about what bacteria actually are. And I knew that, well, it's like Elio Schachter told me, he said, 50% of the world is microbial. So if you don't know a little microbiology, you can't know 50% of yourself.
Hmm.
And so I was highly motivated to share what I learned, but I'm not a teacher, and I didn't really want to play that role. I'm much more like, let's do this together. You know, here's how I learned. This is what it was like to learn it. This is what it took to learn it. And so I was able to cut out some of the really awful feelings and just describe it as a sort of anecdote, or, you know, as a joke or something, you know, make it a little more palatable. But the basic notion of the book is what I learned about microbiology, basic microbiology, enough to navigate the newspapers, and what it was like learning it. So, and it's a pretty simple premise.
And you learned it both in lecture halls, but also in the lab setting, like the applied setting. So you had to learn how to sterilize your tools and how to make like streak plates and do things like that too.
No, we didn't have those kind of labs because.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Cause I didn't, what I did is I went back to school to study biology, because I'd have to be much further along in order to study microbiology. So that was a real bummer when I was like, trotted into Columbia and said, well, I want to study microbiology. And they said, well, what's your science background?
Yeah, these are all your prereqs.
They were like, you know, yeah, go to an online class. So, but I needed the biochops. That was the bottom line. But it's enough. I got enough from that biology, which was just environmental biology, but I got enough to be able to read the papers. Mm-hmm. And to go to lectures and understand what the scientists were talking about. And that was adequate for the purposes of this book, which were ended up really being general principles by which you can navigate what's happened, what the news that's coming in about this new world.
And that really is the difficulty I find for a lot of people. You know, I do this podcast, obviously, which it like runs the gamut. I love to have different science writers and scientists on to talk about all sorts of different cool science topics. But then on the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, the other podcast that I'm a co-host of, it's a lot more about evidence-based thinking, about understanding our cognitive biases, and, you know, just being a good skeptic and knowing how to read the news, knowing how to watch TV with a skeptical lens. And it's tough because I find that like the number one feedback or question or listener email that we get is, how do I know what's a, you know, viable? Like, how do I know what's a good study versus a bad study?
Right.
How do I, you know, how do I know when the New York Times reports on something or when they talk about something on CNN, if they're overblowing it or if it's true?
Right.
And it's tough because, you know, as you know, I mean, you are a journalist, you've worked as a journalist. It's kind of like we have to get clicks. And that's become the culture, is that, you know, journalism is monetized.
Yeah, that's totally the problem. And I think lots of folks, I mean, just basing it on my own experience, you know, I could sense bullshit. You know, when I when you read something like the atmosphere is explosive, because oxygen is, you know, you kind of go, okay, something is, you know, afoul here. But if you don't know anything about atmospheric gases, then you're kind of out of luck. And because so much is happening in the microbial sphere, in microbiology regarding human health, it seemed particularly germane to me to have, you know, some overall kind of guide to what bacteria, primarily, you know, prokaryotes are, and how they live, and how they interact both evolutionarily, but also, you know, contemporarily with different kinds of life forms, plants, soil, animals. That was what I went for.
Yeah, for sure. I have to ask, have you, when you were doing your writing or even before you really dived into this, did you follow at all? Oh, he's one of the two Isons. There's two Isons that are big biologists that are Jonathan. Jonathan's the one.
Yeah.
Did you follow his blog, Microbiomania?
Yeah, I did. And in fact, I even named a chapter after that, Germophobia and Microbiomania. And, you know, of course, credit him for it. He is right on. He's like, he's a skeptic of the first degree, which is just wonderful. But he's also coming up with constant interesting observations and studies. Also, Noah Fryer, I think is how his last name is spelled. I really have gotten a lot of good material following him.
Oh, good.
And finally, Small Things Considered, which is an ASM, American Society of Microbiologists blog that often just kind of pulls it all together.
I love that. Small Things Considered. I'm going to start following it. Oh, that's great.
Okay. It's really, really good. And the sort of founder of it, this fellow, Elio Schachter, who's a, you know, a grand senior microbiologist, he helped me with this book and he read it and made sure I didn't make any seriously stupid mistakes.
Oh, that's so great. Isn't it so great when there are scientists out there who, busy as they may be, like, they're really interested in making sure that the public conversation, because, you know, more people are going to read your book than ever are going to read any of his research. And the fact that he can contribute in such a way that both the public and the more scholastic side of things, I mean, that's just so important. I don't know. I'm such an advocate of good science communication. So I'm so glad when people like yourself write books like this. But it's so great to see scientists who are like, I take a lot of time to make sure that this is done right because I care.
Well, it's also, at the end of the day, it's in their best interest for the microbiological literacy of the population to increase. The more we know, the better we're able to appreciate what these folks are doing.
And so the reason I asked about Jonathan Eisen, and of course, finding out both about Small Things Considered, which again, I love, and Noah Fryer, is because, you know, the thing that I first think, even when I first got your book in the mail, and it was like, Microbia, and then I started to skim the pages, you know, when I first got it and started to read what the editor said about it, or the publishing house said about it, like my first gut reaction anytime there's a new kind of thing written about the microbiome is that it's going to be really, I don't know, it's going to be over the top.
Oh, oversell.
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 It's like the newest, hottest thing. Like everybody's reading about, take your probiotics and, you know, every illness is due to your gut flora. And so I was so glad to see that this was like a really balanced, very deep, skeptical, and just like well-written, informative book, because many people oversell it, don't they?
They do. And I, you know, I understand why that happens, especially the diet books and stuff like that. But if there's some profit to be made, and also the truth is people love a silver bullet. They love a book that says, okay, here it is. Here's the gut microbiome. Here's how it works and what it does and what kind of foods you should eat. But the truth is that you can't make a good decision for yourself unless you have the basic tools to make a judgment. And that to me is, that's what I want to share, because that's what I think makes the difference in life. And to be honest with you, it, you know, I've had these years and years of writing cookbooks. And I know it's like weird that I'm a food writer as well as a nature writer, but actually it's the writing styles are quite similar. They both require really precise thinking and evocative language. So I wrote this book called Well Preserved about canning. And my goal was not to just write these recipes in a vacuum, but to make sure my reader really understood the basic science. What made it safe? Because if you know what makes it safe, when something happens, which it always does, you forget, you answer the phone, something boils too much, whatever, you know how to solve it, or you know what it means, what its implications.
And you know what it looks like or what it smells like, or you know what to eat and what not to eat.
Yeah, it's a kind of knowledge is power. You know, going back to this, you know, it's maybe it's the theme of this talk, but it's a kind of knowledge is power thing. So I'm less involved in promoting a point of view. And I'm more interested in upping the knowledge baseline for others, because it's changed my life so much.
And isn't it interesting how, especially with things like quote unquote germ theory or things like, you know, these very domestic tasks that we've been performing for thousands of years. And even within the last few hundred, we've become, or maybe within the last hundred, we've become more and more aware of the cause that people get sick. We know, you know, now the source of infection, whether it be bacterial or viral or from a parasite or whatever, but that we've evolved and kind of developed these societal understandings even without knowing the science. And the science just helps deepen these understand, like we know when something smells like it's turned. Like people have always, for, you know, especially I think women who have historically tended to these more domestic duties have a very good sense of like if their baby is ill based on the way something smells, or like you said, with canning or with preparing food. Oh, you know, there's a rot here, or there's a smell here, there's a strange color here. And even if historically we didn't understand that's because it's infected, or that's because there are these bacterial processes that are happening, we would know the difference between kind of what seems safe and what doesn't seem safe.
Well, you know, that's such an interesting thing for you to say, because there's actually sort of evolutionary states that we are in that reflect that very thing. So on the one hand, you know, moms will smell a baby's poop, you know, and if it's off, they're like, oh, something's wrong. But on an even, you know, deeper level, there is a study that was done, and women were asked to rate the armpit smell of men and they rated the men who had gonorrhea.
Huh.
I think it was gonorrhea, maybe syphilis, as being more offensive smelling to them.
Thank goodness.
Than those who don't. So here we're talking about an unknown, or, you know, this is something that you don't even realize you're doing, but you're instinctively saying, not that guy.
Oh, that's fascinating. And that's the thing. That's the interesting story here, because we've all heard about these studies where, like, the t-shirt, and then it's like, oh, you smell the t-shirt and then you want to have sex with that guy. And there's all this, like, bad journalism that, like, again, oversells this. But then, like, the fact that there actually is good science supporting the fact that there's something in the odor that's probably secondary to the disease process that does make somebody slightly less attractive. That's huge.
Right. Not as good a mate. I mean, it is a very, you know, there's a lot of material, kind of bits and pieces, of course, but a lot of material that's coming out about how bacteria, they produce these aromatic compounds, their metabolites, or these aromatic compounds that are involved in a whole unseen interplay of reactions that animals have or don't have, attractions and repelling, you know, and feelings of repulsion. So this unseen world of microbes, they're party to our daily life, right? Stuff is going on all the time. Mm-hmm. It's just that our understanding of that is only beginning to be is only beginning to break open.
So we talked about how there are microbes literally everywhere. I think a lot of times when we're reading the news and, like, the stories that are more in the health and wellness and, like, a lot of the kind of goop, you know, pseudoscientific self-helpy stuff, we tend to see a lot of talk about gut flora. Like, that's a big thing in the news. But so I want to get to that because I do think that's important. Like, what's going on inside your digestive tract in the alimentary canal, as it were.
Yeah.
But, but before that, I mean, one thing that we don't often talk about is that there's literally, like, a cloud around your body, right? Of, like, little critters.
Yeah. I know. That's totally awesome to me. I mean, I think about, you know, when I am in a group, you know, like, say a bunch of people at a party, and that we're all sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? We're shedding these microbes, dead ones, live ones, and skin, dead skin cells. We're just shedding all the time. You know, it's like Pigpen from the Peanuts cartoon. I mean, that's really what we're doing. So we're shedding all of these microbes all the time. And the more time, and there's baseline for our species, right? We all have a kind of baseline skin microbiota. And then there's also these individual unique microbiota on top of that that are based on, you know, your gender and your cleanliness and what you eat and various things.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're all shedding these microbial clouds. And the more the more time you spend with people in a room, you enter a party, the more time you spend, the more homogenized those microbial clouds become.
Which makes perfect sense, right?
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. And then, you know, when you leave the room, they drop to the floor and
weird.
You know, and then the next person who comes through might just walk through what was once part of you. But this idea of homogenized microbial clouds, it's kind of a cool way of defining family, because it's really evident with couples, and couples with small children, and couples with children and dogs.
Mm-hmm.
They all share this homogenized, uniquely theirs kind of family microbiota. And it's a microbiome of the family.
Aw, so
pretty cool idea.
So my little guy Killer and I have a lot of shared bacteria between us.
Well, Killer's a dog?
Yeah, Killer's a dog.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah, you probably, I mean, I don't know how much, kind of depends on, do you like have him in your bed?
Oh, yeah. Like, he sleeps right by my face. I give him all the kisses. Oh, we're very close.
All right. Well, yeah, I guess so. So it's a really kind of, to me, it's super cool because why you feel like certain vibes in places.
Mm-hmm.
I know that sounds like a little kooky, but If you're sensing microbial life to the extent where you're turned off by a guy that has gonorrhea, then, you know, what's on a, just on a pure speculative basis, what's not to say that when you walk into a room where there's, or a home, you know, where there's a real microbial presence, you know, a microbiome of the home, do you feel a reaction to that? Mm-hmm. Do you actually respond to that? And if you ever been into the home of, like, say, a hoarder, yeah, in extreme cases, yeah. And there's even some interest in using these microbial sort of fingerprints, using them for forensic purposes, because your unique microbiota is being shed into a room. It comes off your hands and it can be on doorknobs and computer on your laptops and so on. So that's a kind of new area of forensics study.
That's really cool. Our clouds are following us. They're being left behind, and we can actually measure them.
Yeah, yeah, and they can be detected. So yeah, it's a pretty surprising thing. And there's like some studies, relatively small studies, but studies that have suggested that the lingering sort of microbiome of a family that has been present, that's been living in a home, can last for a few days, but a new family moving in quickly colonizes the atmosphere with their own microbiome. And really in that sense, it doesn't take very long for a house to become a home.
All right, guys, I want to take a quick break to thank the sponsors of this week's episode, starting with my favorite, Bombas socks. Guys, I'm so excited to be working with Bombas because they are the most comfortable socks in the history of feet. Of course, that's what they say, and I can't speak for the history of feet, but I can speak for the history of my feet. They really are the most comfortable socks in the history of my feet, and that's because they've completely re-engineered socks from top to bottom to be super innovative. No longer are your socks going to fall down. No longer are they going to dig in and leave a mark. No longer are they going to be too hot in the summer or too cold in the winter. And no longer are they going to scrunch down into your shoes when you're wearing no-show socks. And I've got to admit, my favorite part is this honeycomb arch support system. It literally hugs your foot right around the arch, that most sensitive part. And I'll tell you what, my feet are usually really sore. I get foot massages a lot because of that. I'm on my feet all the time, but not with my Bombas socks. It's gotten to the point where they're the only ones I use. I use them with my regular clothes. I use them with my gym clothes. I use them when I go on hikes. I love my Bombas, but probably even cooler than, I don't know, I can't really compare. I shouldn't say even cooler than, but just as cool as, if not cooler than, the incredible comfort of the socks themselves is that it's a really pro-social company. For every pair they sell, which means for every pair you buy, they donate a pair to a homeless shelter, which is huge because socks are the number one most requested item in homeless shelters, but you can't donate used socks. They need to be brand new. So Bombas has decided to take this upon themselves. So when you buy a pair goes to a homeless shelter. It goes to somebody in need. And to date, they've sold and donated over 7 million pairs. That is huge. So guys, I've been talking about it long enough. Stop listening to me. Try it for yourself. You've just got to go to bombas.com/nerdy and use the offer code nerdy to get 20% off your first order. That's bombas, bombas.com/nerdy. I also want to thank Jamf Now for their support of the show. Jamf Now helps you set up, manage, and protect your Apple devices on demand. Because, of course, think about all the Apple devices you have personally. You can kind of keep track of them, but even that's difficult. But now imagine all of the devices within your organization. Of course, as your business grows, so do all of these Apple devices. And it gets harder and harder to manage the iPads, the iPhones, the Macs, everything. It's especially true if, like me, you have your own business where people who work with you are spread all across the country. So with Jamf now, you can check real-time inventory, you can configure Wi-Fi and email settings, deploy applications, protect your sensitive company data. You can even lock or wipe a device from anywhere. Jamf now manages and protects all of your devices so that you can focus on your business. And of course, there's no IT experience needed, best part. Focus on what you do best and leave this part up to the professionals. You can start securing your business today. You can set up your first 3 devices for free forever. That is such a good deal. And you can add more for just $2 a month per device. I can't think of a better value. So guys, what are you waiting for? Create your free account today at jamf.com/nerdy. That's jamf.com/nerdy. All right, guys, let's get back to the show.
And you know, I think because we're very like human-centered, we tend to think a lot about things in terms of how they affect us. But the truth is, bacteria is all over the planet all the time. Like, that's what soil is. Like, tell me a little bit about sort of the nature of microbia around us that has nothing to do with us.
Regarding those interactions that have nothing to do with us, well, actually, everything affects us down the road because, you know, but setting that rather large notion aside for a minute, soil is ultimately living, dead, and dying microbes on a matrix of minerals.
Mm-hmm.
Fertility in soil is a matter of microbial presence and all of the nutrients that they provide to plants, but all the nutrients they also sequester in soil. So compost is sort of like a probiotic for the plant, you know, because you're adding microbes to enhance the richness of the soil. And a microbial rich soil is going to produce, is going to provide more nutrition, you know, provides nutrition for plants. But one of the really key things in understanding soil is appreciating diversity of microbial life. So fungi, bacteria, archaea, protists, and so on, but especially the fungi and bacteria. That diversity in soil is really key because plants recruit microbes they need to help them deal with stress tolerances and for anything from attacks by aphids to drought. They recruit these microbes as like their helper, their helpers or their mercenaries, and they recruit them by seeping out these like yummy root sweat. It's called exudates, and the soil organisms, bacteria and fungi, they come after that root sweat and deliver various services to the plant. So if you've got soil with a low diversity of microbes, because there always will be bacteria, it's just an ecological principle, right? Every niche is always filled. But if it's filled with a diversity, then that is what provides the most opportunity for a plant to survive adversary conditions.
Is that mindset also translatable to human health?
Yes.
Okay.
You got it. It's like, it's the same model, whether you're talking about soil, plants, or humans, which is why in microbia, here's soil, the soil microbiome, the plant microbiome, the animal microbiome. They actually are all this, it's very similar model over and over again. We get our first microbes from mom, right? Mm-hmm. When we travel through the birth canal, we pick up microbes that we need. When we breastfeed, we pick up bacteria that we need. And that's like the first successive layer, you know? So in succession, you've got like, you have your pioneer species, and then they're replaced by they're added on to by more mature species, and then the environment diversifies. Same thing goes with soil, with plants, and with us. After we get our initial microbiome from mom, which is what plants do too. They get their initial microbiome from mom as it comes with the seed. Mm-hmm. And so that that microbiome diversifies, kind of sets up the sort of engineers the gut of the baby. And then the gut microbiome diversifies with the foods you eat.
I'm just wondering, you know, because I'm always on the fence about the idea of probiotics, and there's prescription probiotics, but there's also a lot of kind of health woo around probiotics that somehow they could solve every problem, and that we need to take the pills that are super expensive that have like 10,000 versus 50,000 versus 100,000. Like, at what point is it overkill?
Right. Well, it's like, we're at that.
Okay.
I think so. I mean, probiotics is, there's a lot of study being done. Where it's at right now is probiotics are used in some clinical situations where they're extremely helpful if you have certain kinds of diarrhea. Mm-hmm. But so a probiotic is live bacteria, right? The idea is you increase the numbers of the live bacteria in your system. That's why I was saying, like, compost is like a probiotic. You're increasing the number of live bacteria in the system.
Yeah.
The thing is that probiotics in our bodies are transient probiotics. So they are probiotics. So we have two types of bacteria that live in us. We've got permanent residents, mm-hmm. Who feed on stuff we eat and kind of stay there and live in us all the time. And then we have transients. And those transient and permanent microbes, they interact to do a lot of services for us that are important. And then the transient microbes, as well as dead permanent guys, they come out the other end.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. So when you take a probiotic, you can't take probiotics for 2 days and go, okay, I've just upped my bacterial, my quote unquote good bacteria numbers, which don't get me started on the good versus bad bacteria. Or maybe you should. It drives me so crazy. It's really has to be a regular part of your diet. So if you're going to be truly take advantage of the probiotic opportunities, that would mean eating fermented foods like yogurt or kefir or whatever as a regular part of your diet, because you're pooping it out. So you want to just you just incorporate it into your diet. So I don't know, you eat yogurt every other day or something, and it's best to make it yourself, which is really stupid easy.
Oh, really?
Fermented foods are stupid easy to make. Oh God. Yeah. Because you don't do anything. You just give them what they need and then they ferment.
And it's not dangerous. I'd be so scared I'd be eating something dangerous.
Yeah. No. I suppose that something could get a weird infection, but don't worry about it. Much better to make your own yogurt. There's a lot of great recipes online. I've written about them in my books on canning, or make your own sauerkraut and stuff like that, or kimchi, whatever your bag is, and just incorporate it into your regular diet. And that will provide some of those necessary transients.
So why do you think it is that people buy like the really expensive probiotics, like even people who aren't sick?
Right. So they're trying to increase their health, because and folks will say it makes them feel better. And if it does, that's great. There's not any real science there to back it up. That doesn't mean there won't in the future, but right now those yogurts and stuff are a lot of marketing and a little bit of science.
Gotcha.
Right. Gotcha. Same thing with probiotic creams for your face. You have maybe seen them. There's like a whole bunch of different companies that are producing like probiotic face masks and it's the same problem. Little bit of science, lot of packaging.
Yeah. And that's always the case when we're dealing with consumer products that like aren't subject to FDA approval, like things that are non-drugs, or supplements where it just says like these claims have not been reviewed by the FDA or whatever. Like we're not trying to make
a
problem. But on the other side of that, we're talking about the permanent residents versus the transient residents. What about poop transplants for C. diff? And now I think we're starting to see more research in even other types of gut illnesses.
Right. So the thing about fecal transplants, which is, spraying fecal matter into your anus.
Very graphic.
It's just like I have a little video that I sometimes look at.
I love it.
It's not really that bad. It's just like it looks sort of like a water pick. It goes in there, just sprays this liquid. It's not like you get a hunk of poop in there. It's not disgusting. Yeah. It's just a little wash. And the idea is that in the case of C. diff, you've got an overgrowth of this really problematic organism. But we have to back up. Like, how do you get C. diff, right? Yeah. So C. diff happens because, as we were talking about earlier, it's an ecological thing. Every habitat will always be filled with microbes, right? If there is an opening in that habitat, imagine a neighborhood and a house becomes available, then an organism is going to move into that space. Mm-hmm. One of the ways that bacteria protect us, one of the things that makes them our allies, is that commensal bacteria, they fill in all the spaces, so there's no room for a pathogen to get a foothold. But when you take antibiotics or have a catastrophic illness like, say, cholera, you can open up apartments, you can open up these empty spaces on your skin or in your gut that where a pathogen may be able to get a foothold.
Because you've annihilated that kind of niche.
Because you've opened the space and they can move in. And C. diff is able to kind of almost like hibernate. It can stay quiet in your guts and not cause you any trouble until like an opportunity arises, and then it can move in and proliferate if there's enough open space and enough of and the environment allows that.
And of course, it's named for the fact that it makes people very sick, right? It's a Clostridium, but it's called Clostridium difficile.
It can kill you.
Yeah, like people get portions of their intestines removed because they're so ill from it.
Yeah, it's completely nasty. It's like a really bad weed. It's an invasive species. It takes over this space, and it causes terrible dysbiosis, and so it's been really hard to treat. Antibiotics haven't been useful because they're able to sort of hibernate, into the spore. They have a little hard, a little endospore that they create, so they're able to sort of survive. But the fecal transplant is very effective. So the question is, what's working? Are you just displacing the C. diff with your natural symbionts? And because they're your evolutionary partner, those bacteria are just going to muscle out the C. diff? Well, maybe, but nobody knows exactly why, which is why doctors aren't jumping to the conclusion of giving you a fecal transplant if you have C. diff. Because they don't really know why it works.
And do you think it could have something to do with the route of administration? That just because when we eat probiotics, a lot of them are going to die on the way to get where they're trying to go.
Right.
And when you absorb through your rectum, you're getting things into the intestines a lot more intact, I guess.
Yeah, maybe that could be. Although there was this small study out of Germany, and it was described to me by a doctor who does the fecal transplants here at Mount Sinai in New York City. And he said to me, what the study showed is these researchers filtered fecal matter used in a fecal transplant through a very fine filter. So they filtered out all the bacteria.
Oh, interesting.
The only thing that was left were these sort of secondary metabolites and viruses.
Okay.
So they kind of washed, they shot that up inside the C. diff patients, and the patients got well too.
So it could be a lot more than just the bacteria.
Right. What is the major predator of bacteria?
Viruses.
Viruses. Yep.
Hmm.
So it's like, whoa, it's even deeper and more complex and more gorgeous than we thought.
Interesting.
I mean, I don't know. That's one study, but it just, is a little bit of an eye-opener for a lot of people who've heard about it.
So many eye-openers. You tackle a lot of really interesting questions in your book. There's a couple of them that I would love to talk about because I love to kind of dispel myths. So one thing that you mention is why it is that graveyards don't make people sick. Like, why don't we go to a graveyard and catch dead people disease?
Right. I know it's interesting, but that's actually such a good question because it really goes to the heart of the matter of why we aren't all dead. Mm-hmm. You know, why aren't microbes just taking us out? Well, you know, disease, you know, these pathogens, if somebody dies of a pathogenic disease, if that pathogen no longer has the environment, the niche that it needs to survive, it won't. And if the living body is that environment, it's not going to survive anymore after the body is mm-hmm. dead. Likewise, once exposed to an array of other microbes that very easily might predate the pathogen. So the pathogen has got like two problems. One, its niche has changed. Mm-hmm. Its environment is not the same anymore. And two, there are a lot of enemies all of a sudden in that soil.
Hmm.
So one or the other reason is why, if there's a little pathogenic bacterium that made the individual sick, the chances of it surviving are, you know, the reason why we're not getting typhoid every time we walk into a cemetery or TB.
That's such an important point. And, you know, I had Caitlin Doty on the podcast a long time ago, and she's a mortician who writes a lot about alternative death practices and dying a good death and dying in the home and things. And one of the things that she teaches people to sort of empower them is that unless somebody dies of a really infectious disease, like they're septic when they die, the bacteria that makes a body smell when it starts to decompose is not the same kind of bacteria that makes people sick. And a lot of times, yeah, we have this idea that like just because something smells bad or just because something isn't, I don't know, what we think of as quote unquote healthy, like that it's going to make us ill, but that's not the case.
No, those bacteria that are like chopping on proteins on our carcass mm-hmm. are producing the byproducts, these aromatics that are quite stinky, but they have a reason. They attract insects who are the real disassemblers of corpses.
I see.
So they're, yeah, that smell, you know, the flies come, the critters come and they smell that, you know, it's a come hither scent, you know, it grosses us out, but it's, you know, to various little, you know, beetles, it's heaven.
I love that. So it really is this great interwoven kind of positive feedback loop.
You got it. You got it. And that's what makes, you know, that's the thing about studying biology as a, you know, English major. It just is a mind expanding appreciation of how gloriously complex what a tapestry nature is and how we're really woven into it very profoundly. You know, just look at mitochondria.
Mitochondria are so fascinating, aren't they?
Oh, yeah.
And also chloroplasts.
Yes. Oh, all the time, you know, when we talk about, when I talk to folks about how bacteria and archaea are at the bottom of the food chain, right? They bridge the non-living and living worlds. They grab inorganic carbon and terrestrialize it, make it organic. And then folks, so they're the, you know, all other organisms depend on this magnificent capture events that that bacteria and archaea do. And then people go, well, what about plants? Mm-hmm. And I'm always thrilled when they do, because then I go, well, the part of plants that actually do that are chloroplasts, and chloroplasts are the descendants of an ancient cyanobacteria. So it's still bacteria that are doing the job.
And of course, this is why mitochondrial DNA is different than cellular DNA, isn't it? Or I should say, not cellular, but nuclear DNA. Yeah.
Exactly. Because if your mitochondrial DNA gets loose in your bloodstream, your immune system will attack it because it'll recognize it as alien DNA.
That's so cool.
After all these billions of years. Yeah, it's totally cool to think that we've always, you know, people, myself included, tend to think that we evolved from bacteria and archaea. Mm-hmm. But in actuality, we've been with them. We've evolved with them all along. They've never gone away.
They're still deeply, deeply a part of us, both kind of separate from us, but on us and in us, and also really deeply intertwined with us.
Yeah. I mean, without your mitochondria, you'd be very, very lethargic, to say the least.
Yeah. AKA dead. We'd probably be dead.
It's true. It's true. It's a really kind of beautiful reality that this notion that we are, you know, independent, that our decisions affect only us, you know, it just goes away once you realize that at our deepest essence, we are microbial.
Oh, absolutely. And so is our food. I mean, and we're not just talking about eating bacteria, but the fact that we eat plants, the fact that we eat meat, they also have these deep relationships with bacteria. So one more kind of trivia question, which I'm fascinated by, is this argument always between grass-fed beef versus more traditional beef, which of course, you know, we mostly feed our agricultural animals corn at this point. How are those different diets actually affecting us?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting when you, and it was a revelation to me, I guess, that so a beef cattle is evolved to eat grass. They have this, you know, this incredible multi-chambered stomach that are full of organisms that break down the grass they eat, because animals can't eat cellulose. It's the bacteria in them that break down cellulose. Mm-hmm. And in fact, and they produce their methogens. They'll produce a lot of methane gas, you know, pooping cows. I think there was a barn in Germany last year that these farting cows, they farted so much methane that they blew up their barn with them in it. Boom. Anyway, that's their kind of traditional, that's their food, right? It's to eat grass. But we feed them grain to fatten them up and to salt, and it makes the meat very creamy and all that. But what, and the cattle are able to digest the grain, but there is a conversion that happens in their gut from being a gut dominated by cellulose, you know, fermenters, to being these bacteria that break down the grains, mm-hmm. right? And if you make that transition when you're feeding your cow too fast, then they can get sick. There's buildup of acids and all kinds of funky things that happen, and the cow gets sick. Well, so in terms of, you know, the nutritional value of what we eat, I would say that there's less problems with eating cattle that has benefited from grain than the fact that cattle that have been grain fed have often been fed antibiotics. And those antibiotics are showing up in people's guts and, you know, what they're doing. It's all like, you know, there's not a whole lot of science out there, because it's actually can be very difficult to do research on some of these big industrial food systems. There's resistance, I guess.
Sure.
And so that's happening for sure. So that's the same thing goes, you know, for this paleo diet phenomena. So people say, okay, our guts didn't evolve to eat grain, and that's why we have all of these contemporary diseases. And that's actually just kind of nonsense, because your gut will, if you're going to survive, you're going to survive because you have either your own genes or you have the genes in the microbes that live in you that produce enzymes that break down whatever food is available. So we have plenty of, we could have plenty of microbes that break down grains. Mm-hmm. No problem. You know, you can change your diet in a matter of, you know, in a matter of, I don't know, a generation, and be able to eat all kinds of foods. In fact, the diversity of microbes in your gut is what allows what allows an organism to take advantage of new food opportunities. So if grain's a new food opportunity and you've got some you've acquired some microbes to break them down and get nutrition from them, you're going to make it. You're going to survive the day.
It really is about making sure that our diet is like incredibly varied, isn't it? It seems like every evidence-based person that I talk to who has some knowledge in this area, whether it be a nutritionist or a physician or a researcher, it's like, just eat a lot of different things, a lot of different colored things, things from different sources, and you're pretty much going to be okay.
Exactly. That's true. And also add to that an appreciation of non-sterilized foods, right? So we're involved in this, what this one wonderful plant pathologist at Rutgers described as the great sterilization experiment. We sterilize baby food. We feed our babies sterilized baby food. We sterilize all our food. We're super involved in killing germs, and yet in the process, we're not getting a diversity of microbes. And he's the one who said, "You want to know what nature's microbiome diet is? Go into the garden, pull up a carrot, wipe off the dirt, and then eat the carrot. That's the way you get the microbes you need." So the nature of our diet. Our gut microbiome, the species, the populations and the population types and the population ratios are a reflection of what we eat. So that's why, you might think that you're eating this really fantastic, healthy diet, but the chances are your microbiome, the species that are present, the genera that are present are pretty much the same as the Prime Minister of France.
Yeah, because our food, even when we eat fresh vegetables, unless we're getting them at a farmer's market from our own backyard, if they're produced on an industrial scale, they were probably irradiated, weren't they?
Yeah, there's that. I mean, it's like, it's all the way, up and down the line. You know, it's kind of every step of the way, our behaviors are undermining microbial diversity. I mean, just the fact when I was out this morning, I saw this lady with a little thing of Purell hanging from her purse,
common
to it all the time, and I'm thinking, wow, you're nuking all these like commensal bacteria on your hands. And so if you get a cut, some like wicked thing could get in there, because all of your allies are gone or nuked. But the a diversity of foods is key to getting a diversity of microbes.
It's
sterile.
It really comes down to a basic literacy of wellness, of science, of microbiology, because I think a lot of people might go, oh, you can't just eat a carrot straight out of the ground. What if you get an E. coli infection? And you're like, no. The reason E. coli shows up in spinach is because like one person on the line didn't wash their hands after going to the bathroom. Like those are two very different sources of infection.
People, it's this notion of good bacteria versus bad bacteria is really gets in the way. I think it's like the first thing we need to like let go of, because the way I came to what really helped me understand why good versus bad bacteria is just a misnomer was when I was in class and there's a very typical kind of ecological story that they tell about Yellowstone Park. So I'm sure you're aware of this one. The ranchers around Yellowstone get pissed off because the wolves were eating all their sheep. So the Parks Department took out the wolves. The deer population went crazy. They increased to great numbers. They beat up they hung around the stream beds and they eroded the stream banks and they grazed on the willows. No willows meant no material for beavers to make their dams, which meant no ponds. So the ducks didn't come. It was this cascading effects. The Parks Department put the wolves back into Yellowstone, and the ecosystem recalibrated. The wolves started predating the deer. The deer stayed on the move. They didn't just eat willows. And the beaver came back and so on.
Yes. And just to interject for a second, anybody who listens to the podcast on a regular basis, if you remember episode 189 with Nate Blakesley, he wrote a book all about 06, who is a wolf that really symbolized this movement, who was killed by a hunter. But he talks all about this very story in that book.
Yeah, it's an incredible, I mean, they teach it in every bio class. I mean, it's a huge kind of, you know, mind expanding thing that, you know, every player in the ecosystem is important. However, the numbers are just as important. The deer aren't bad in and of themselves. Deer species, they're not bad. They're bad in the wrong numbers for the ecosystem. And so the same thing is true of us. And that's why saying, okay, there's good bacteria and bad bacteria, not really. There's only too many or too few bacteria for the ecosystem, which would be you.
Yeah, very, very good point. Well, Eugenia, I have kept you for over an hour. I have been learning so very much. Yeah, can you believe it?
No, I can't.
I know. We can keep talking for hours longer. But I do close every episode asking my guests the same two questions. And I am really interested to hear your answers to these questions that are a bit big picture. So are you ready for that?
Okay, I'll do my best.
All right. So I want you to think about the future in whatever context is relevant to you right now. It could be a personal context. It could be global. It could be even more galactic, as it were. But I want you to tell me first, what is the thing that sort of keeps you up the most at night, that you're most concerned about, that maybe you have a bit of a pessimistic view of? You know, what is it? What is the thing that you're most concerned about? But on the flip side of that, what are you genuinely, like honestly, not lip service, hopeful and optimistic and excited for?
Well, I think there's no doubt that I'm most freaked out about antibiotic resistance. It is a huge problem. I mean, I can, as a result of writing this book, I can imagine a future, a near future, where a simple procedure like a C-section could, you know, could kill women, could cause women's death. I mean,
more than it already does for complication reasons.
Oh yeah, I mean, or a tonsillectomy, you know, could all of a sudden be a matter of life and death. So, so that is a you know, I can't help but think, wow, you know, cuts, you know, my son is working with these big saws right now and he cut his thumb. What if he cut off his, you know, in the future without antibiotics, what would happen?
Gosh, so we'd be back to the pre-antibiotic era. Like, I remember, sorry to interject, but I tell this story a lot. I remember I had Maren McKenna on the podcast in the first year. It was really early. It was, you know, recently she wrote a book called Big Chicken, which is about antibiotic resistance in farm animals. But the book that we talked about then, Superbug, was about MRSA, methicillin-resistant staph. And I asked her about this new strain of kind of resistant gonorrhea and, you know, what's going to happen when it's finally, you know, there's finally a version of it that's completely resistant to all antibiotics on the market. And she said she asked a researcher about that. And he said, you know, what do you do? What do you do if you contract this infection? And his answer, don't get gonorrhea.
Yeah.
Like there is nothing you could do at that point.
Exactly. Ugh. I mean, it's on a, you know, it would be, it potentially can usher in an era of grief.
Yeah.
So on the other hand, because of all of the interesting work that's happening with microbiology, and the reason why everybody needs to like get behind it, is there are new ways, the researchers are considering new ways to break up the biofilm formation, to break up the very aspect of bacteria that allows them to present virulence in the first place. Mm-hmm. And that is magnificent, because that means, you know, you would interrupt, you wouldn't be killing the bacteria, and whatever that would mean to the ecosystem at large, but you just interrupt their ability. It's sort of like giving them a vasectomy. It's just interrupting their ability to present virulence. And that work is really viable. It's really happening. And to me, it's like, it's the pure gracefulness of science with combined with a world important application.
Ugh, so cool. Gosh, it really, like, there are new vistas in front of us. This idea of, just like you said, preventing virulence, this idea of universal vaccines, like all of these really neat like approaching the problem in a different way and potentially having massive global impact.
Yeah.
It's so exciting.
But it only happens if you look deeply. You know, yeah. It's like it's really by looking into the unseen world, our sight can clear. That's how I see it anyway.
What a perfect note to end this fabulous conversation on. Guys, the book is Microbia, A Journey into the Unseen World Around You. Check it out. It's just so informative. It's so well written and it's really compelling. And Eugenia, thank you so much for joining me on the show. This was a blast.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
I'm so glad. And everyone listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.